The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. And as we've been saying all season, the title race is wide open. Liverpool go top after a comfortable win in Bournemouth, while a David Luiz-inspired Chelsea condemned City to their first defeat of the season. The real condemnation, though, is for the row of Chelsea fans spitting venomous bile at Raheem Sterling for no apparent reason, with the police and the club investigating accusations of racism. Elsewhere on the pitch, we'll praise Son, Torreira and Felipe Anderson. In Scotland, Celtic are back on top. River Plate finally win the Copa Libertadores and Messi is still really quite good. We'll round up the Football League, look ahead to a huge week of Champions League action, take your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. A panel today. Vishali Bardwaj from The Standard, how are you?
Yes, very well.
You didn't have courgettes for breakfast.
I didn't.
But was that because we criticised you the last time?
Possibly.
Okay, well, I'd like to apologise for changing your eating habits like that. Jacob Steinberg.
Hi.
It's been too long. Nice to have you here.
Thanks.
Barry, it's hasn't been long enough.
Hello.
But you are here.
Yeah, I mean, Vishali could have had courgettes and then just lied if she'd wanted.
Do you sense she's untrustworthy?
I'm not suggesting she lied. I'm just saying she it was an option that was open to her.
True.
Like courgettes for breakfast.
Maybe I'm just less cynical about people and I'd take them at face value, Barry.
Okay.
So you were at Stamford Bridge, Vishali, to see Chelsea defeat Manchester City.
Yes, I was.
Manchester City are beatable, it turns out.
They are, absolutely. And, you know, when we were looking at the start of the season, you were thinking, well, it'd probably be the likes of Liverpool, who obviously beat them last season, who might inflict a defeat on them. Obviously, they couldn't do that at Anfield, but it turns out it's Chelsea who can do that. There is a very good side there at Chelsea. It's just that they're not necessarily showing that every single week. Something that Sarri talked about before that game. Obviously, they'd lost to Wolves, they'd lost to Spurs on the road to, you know, back-to-back away defeats. And he's seen a bit of complacency from some of his players off the back of that unbeaten run up until they went to Wembley. And he called for a reaction, and he definitely got a reaction. It was a case for Chelsea of defending really well in the first half. And when the opportunity to score presented itself, they took it. And then second half, they were very, very good. I mean, City, I was quite surprised at how they were making some really uncharacteristic mistakes, you know, losing possession, giving the ball away. And then, of course, that second goal came. And, you know, you have to think that David Luiz was a huge part of that win for Chelsea. But yeah, a really good result for Chelsea. Amazing atmosphere at Stamford Bridge. One of the best of the season so far.
David Luiz, you've mentioned, Barry. When he's bad, he's bad. And when he's good, he's good.
I think he's a terrific player. But yeah, he has had a couple of, you know, famous shockers. Notably the Brazil-Germany game at the World Cup. But I don't think his importance can be understated for Chelsea. I just saw this morning, you know, his long-term future, there's some doubt over, because he's at that age now where Chelsea will only offer him a one-year extension, and, you know, he might look for more. But he was, along with Azpilicueta on Saturday, I think, the standout player, and his goal was brilliant, his defending was brilliant, and, you know, he is an object of mockery and derision in some quarters, and I think people who think he isn't very good, they're just wrong. He is a terrific player.
Simon says, after reading Chelsea fans moan about how Sarri's tactics had been found out last week, do we need to stop making sweeping judgments on a team and their tactics off the back of a couple of results? It used to be called form, which comes and goes. Now there has to be a narrative, Jacob.
Well, one of the things I think with Chelsea is that for about 15 years under, since Mourinho turned up at Chelsea, they've been a really hard and defensive side, quite physical, very, very robust and difficult for teams like City to take on. And Sarri's ushering a new kind of philosophy, and that's not going to happen overnight. It's been difficult at times when they've tried to move away from that more physical style that Mourinho introduced when he first came, and which really stayed with the club for a long time after he left it in the first spell. So Sarri is obviously trying to change the way they play to be more possession, more attacking, and we've seen that there's been a bit of you know, resistance at times to the Jorginho Kante swap and everything, and people suggesting that Kante should move back into that role. Of course, if you're going to persist with the way that Sarri wants to play, you're going to have a player like Jorginho playing at the base of that midfield. So I think he's going to need patience. Chelsea are also reining in their spending. They didn't really spend too much in the summer as compared to what we used to see under Abramovich when he first arrived. The first 5 or 10 years of Abramovich at Chelsea, but they were the biggest spenders, and they don't really challenge City on that score, and they don't really, to be honest, they haven't really been challenging Liverpool on that front in the last year or two. So I do think he's going to need time. Although they've won on Saturday, I think he's also going to need probably a better number nine. Obviously, Morata wasn't even in the squad on Saturday with Hazard up front. I'm not really sure that Hazard enjoys playing there.
No, it was kind of refreshing, wasn't it, to hear him afterwards go, you know, he gets interviewed and he says, "Did you like that?" And 99 of 100 footballers just go, "Oh, I'll just do whatever the manager wants. I'm happy with the result." And he said, "Actually, it's not really my cup of tea."
Yeah, well, he was running over, wasn't he, to Sarri after about half an hour when Chelsea were under the cosh and saying, "I'm not really enjoying this." And obviously, we saw what happened with Conte when he played Hazard there last season in the City away game. So you'd imagine that he will want to sign a striker. He obviously wanted to sign Higuain in the summer, who he worked with at Napoli, and he ended up going elsewhere. So I think that for Chelsea to win the league eventually, I don't think it will happen this season, he's going to need someone else. But he's going to need time. He's going to need to have some patience, which Chelsea haven't always given their managers. And he's going to need a bit more backing as well.
Vishali, is playing a false nine the way to beat Manchester City?
Well, it wasn't working, was it? Up until about the first goal, it wasn't working because Hazard hardly had a touch on the ball. And that was, when I looked at the lineup, that's exactly what I said. Last season, when Antonio Conte played that same false number nine with Hazard up front. And that was also because Alvaro Morata wasn't really scoring at that time. The problem was he was often starved of service. And if you play him up front, you need to get the ball to him. And if you don't get the ball to him, he's going to be left wandering around the pitch by himself. And that's what you were seeing, what was going on at Stamford Bridge. Of course, then he got involved for the first goal, and it was his cutback that Kante scored. I don't necessarily think it's the way to beat City. I think Hazard would have been much more effective back on the left flank. But the problem, as Jacob has mentioned, is that they don't have a striker who Sarri at the moment necessarily trusts. I mean, Alvaro Morata being dropped completely from the squad was because he hasn't been scoring, and it was basically him or Giroud in the squad. And Giroud's been scoring, so you have to have him in the squad over Morata. But if you had a number nine up front, a Diego Costa type player who is scoring goals, is in form, of course he would have started up front. I think the interesting thing about sort of Sarri's plan being all the criticism that's been talked about that is because he keeps on insisting there is no other way that he wants to play apart from this sort of Sarri balls type of style of play. And that's why everyone's saying, well, where is your plan B? Interestingly, at Stamford Bridge on Saturday, we saw he actually accepted that they wouldn't have the majority of possession. So actually, let's play a more counter-attacking approach. So he did show that he kind of does have a different version of play if he needs it. But he's very much a stubborn manager. He's got his style of play, and that's how he wants him to succeed in. Whether or not he'll be able to do that this season remains to be seen.
You were trying to tell me yesterday, Barry, that David Luiz ball was not Sarri ball, was just a
dirty long ball up the channel.
What a great pass, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I think it was all in the way that Pedro took it down. But, yeah, interesting on BT Sports, Steve McManaman said moments before that happened that is what they should try and do, adopt the tactics. And, you know, for 44 minutes of the game, Chelsea were getting absolutely slaughtered, basically. They couldn't get any time on the ball. They were, you know, being pressed into panic, couldn't string too many passes together. And I think while their victory is commendable, I do think that the complacency of Manchester City's players could be their undoing. I've said it before that I think that's their biggest threat to the title now. Obviously, Liverpool are as well after the weekend's result, but I do think City's players have the ball so much of the time that they just get a bit complacent and sloppy.
It's one of the things that's always been under Pep's size. I think that you could go back to a few Champions League games with Barcelona where they had so much possession and so many chances where they just seemed to think at times that it was just going to come. And you think about the and then they'd end up losing at certain points. And you think about the Sané moments where he was right in front of goal, wanted to take another touch, where sometimes it feels like it's a little bit too easy. Another thing for them as well, no Aguero on Saturday. It was a big miss because Jesus isn't playing well this season. I think he's got one goal and Aguero, I think if any of those chances had perhaps fallen to him, Chelsea would have found themselves.
And Jesus has got that look. He doesn't look confident. In the same way you mentioned Morata, you know, that sort of strikers that look like they miss a chance and it really affects them, as opposed to other ones who it's just water off.
He's young, but then it happened with Sané as well. He wasn't inside at the start of the season and is now starting to get back into the groove we saw last year.
Vishal, it's interesting. You mentioned it was a great atmosphere at Stamford Bridge. The one bit of footage that we have all seen is just the absolute rage from those men as Raheem Sterling goes to pick up the ball. And obviously we've seen that slowed down and repeated and repeated. Presumably at the game you didn't notice that at all, when we see that at every football ground, every game we go to. Right?
No, I didn't see it. I only saw it first. I think it was sort of just when the second half started, or some point during the second half. It was on social media, and one of the journalists next to me just showed me the footage, and I couldn't believe it. But Raheem Sterling didn't actually tell the referee at the time, so we didn't know anything like that had actually happened. And then, of course, we talked to people at Chelsea to find out what was going on, and we realised just how bad it was, the severity of it afterwards. But it was a horrific incident.
Yeah, listen, we at this stage... we've all watched it. I'm sure you have watched the footage a bunch of times. The racism is alleged at this stage, and we have to say that. Barry, it's those people to be that angry. Right, there are two things here. One is, you know, what Sterling said on Instagram afterwards, and how you know, he has been, the treatment he's had from some areas of the press has been incredibly poor, and we've mentioned that before. And the other part is just the incredible rage of people at football to footballers, and how we sort of accept that, oh, I just go there to let off steam up. That's an acceptable form of behaviour.
Well, we discussed this on the radio yesterday, and some listeners accused us of being middle class and not understanding football and the passion fans have for the game. It's perfectly possible to have plenty of passion for the game, as I do, as you do, I know you do, you're probably more passionate about it than I am, without, you know, shouting, being incandescent with rage and shouting vile abuse, whether it was racist or not remains to be seen, but it was vile abuse regardless, at a footballer just because he doesn't play for your team. I don't understand that kind of behaviour. I don't lose my temper much. I certainly don't lose it to that extent, and not over something as stupid as football. So to see middle-aged men doing it, it's just weird. I can't get my head around it, but it happens all the time. It happened at Hearts yesterday. I'll touch on that later. It happens at football grounds all over the country. It's not just a Chelsea thing.
I don't have a problem so much with the general hostility that you get at football. I don't, when I go as a fan on rare occasion, I personally can't get myself into that kind of rage. I also think that it's part of it at times with, you maybe being hostile, trying to make it a hostile environment for an away player. On the flip side, I don't understand why those Chelsea fans would get so worked up about Raheem Sterling. I can understand why a Liverpool fan, why Liverpool, when he goes there, the way that he left, why they get very worked up around Raheem Sterling. Other fans have no reason to target him, but he's booed often wherever he goes, and he's often the England player who everybody latches onto and targets. And when he misses a chance, it's, oh, Sterling's rubbish, get him out the side, he's useless. And I think that there is something in the way that, first of all, some people react towards young black footballers or black football of any age, which makes him a target, and also the way that the media has spoken about him, which has drummed up a certain perception of Raheem Sterling as a money-grabbing so-and-so.
He made the point on Instagram, didn't he? He compared how the press, I think it was the Daily Mail, did the story about Tosin Adebayo, who's on loan at West Brom now, but part of Pep's plans, bought a house for his mum, and how that was presented as, this is an outrage, and then how they presented Phil Foden buying a house for his mum, you know, City starlet buys house for mum. I mean, and they're exactly the same story, and Raheem Sterling was making a very good point, Vishali.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think he hit the nail on the head with that post. I've been deeply uncomfortable with the way he's been targeted by certain publications, not all publications, it's only certain publications, I think it's fair to say, continue to write negative stories, often negative stories about him. But what he was then doing with that Instagram post was basically holding a mirror up. It, you know, the same publication has written essentially the same story about two Manchester City teammates. I mean, neither of them have broken into the first team. So whether or not one has made a Premier League appearance or not, really, it doesn't really matter because they both are not, you know, first team regulars under Pep Guardiola. But the exact same story, they've bought their mums, I think it was, houses. But the way that it was presented with Tosin was completely different. You know, and then that's when you start to wonder, why has it been presented slightly differently? Is it a race issue? And, you know, I seem to kind of move towards that kind of
way of
thinking.
How entrenched do you think it is? I mean, do you genuinely think at those papers they're like, write a bad story about Raheem Sterling because he's black? Like, it can't be that, no, it can't be that blatant.
No, I don't think. I think this is a bigger issue. I think it's not just about football and the media. I think it is a cultural thing. I don't think it's overt racism. You just wonder how subconscious it is sometimes. And they also know that they'll sell papers if they write about Raheem Sterling, unfortunately now, because they've written so much about him. And then you wonder how that then affects fans when they read that again and again and again. And then you see fans doing what they did on Saturday, and you think, how much have they actually been affected by the continued negative coverage that Raheem Sterling attracts? I don't think it's overt. I mean, I've worked in plenty of newsrooms. I haven't seen that kind of overt racism. Certainly, no, I've never actually seen it. But you just wonder how subconscious it is.
I think it's interesting as well that he picked up two stories that, well, obviously the one about Tosin was not to do with him, but he's picked up stories that had nothing to do with him from the Daily Mail. And he could have picked up anything from the Sun, those front pages that we've seen about Raheem Sterling, and he could have spoken about himself. Instead, he's talking about actually someone who is probably in a less powerful position than him, a younger footballer who hasn't made his debut for Manchester City. And it seems like that might be something that they're speaking about in private, and that it's something that spreads beyond simply Raheem Sterling, but something that all black footballers in this country are starting to become extremely uncomfortable with. And I think it's very commendable of Sterling that he hasn't actually just spoken about himself and said, look at what you're doing to me, but look at what you're doing to this part of society as a whole.
It was very generous of him to do that, because he didn't mention any of the coverage he's got himself, and that would have been a very long list. I think, you know, it feeds itself and just snowballs. The more they publish, the more it is read, and as Shelley said, it just keeps going and going and going. But interestingly, the Sun, who have targeted him a lot, they published his Instagram post, but cropped out the bit where he blamed the media for what was happening to Tosin. So you know, that tells you all you need to know, really. It should
What's
be stressed.
The solution?
We have spoken about this at length before on this podcast, and other people have banged the drum about it as well, but it should be stressed. It tends not to be sports writers who do this. It's news reporters at the front end of the paper.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it was Piers Morgan. I loathe to say his name, but it was Piers Morgan who latched onto the gun tattoo and really made it a big issue during the World Cup. And obviously, he is not a sports reporter, but he's had a prominent place on Breakfast TV. Talk about it. The other thing is, I thought it was a really powerful statement from Kick It Out, from Lord Ousley yesterday morning, saying that there's a vacuum of leadership at the top of the game. Where have the FA been? Where are the Premier League? Where are Chelsea tackling this kind of thing? Where are other Premier League clubs?
Look, obviously, it's a story that is not going to go away, and we'll definitely touch on it again. Back to the game, Barry, briefly.
Well, just BT Sport had the rights here in the UK, and Joe Cole and Rio Ferdinand were among the pundits, and they had a discussion, not on air, but it's since been leaked, and they very much pointed the big finger of blame at Kyle Walker and said he was a liability. But Joe Cole said, I'm not going to say that on air because a mate of his goes to the gym with me.
That's brilliant. I'll let Man City host Hoffenheim on Wednesday. Pep was asked last week about whether City could be banned from the Champions League as punishment for flouting FFP rules. He said, we will not be banned. That's what I think. I trust what my chairman and CEO have explained to me. If it does happen, we'll accept it and move on. So watch this space. Liverpool are top of the league. 4-0 win at Bournemouth. Their best start to a top flight campaign in their history continues. 13 wins and 3 draws so far this season. Jacob, do we need to take them seriously as title contenders now?
Now?
Yeah.
We'll be not. I've been taking them seriously since August.
We've been giving Man City a sort of 10-point at least.
Yeah, I still think City will win the league. I think they've got they've been winning so convincingly, and they've been doing that without their best player basically all season. Kevin De Bruyne hasn't played a handful of games. So as and when he comes back, you'd expect them to become even better. I think they have a higher level than Liverpool do. And obviously City have already gone to Anfield, which is their least favourite ground. So that's one game they've got out of the way. But yeah, Liverpool are a very good side. Champions League final last season. And they aren't conceding this season. They've got better with Van Dijk. And although they've lost Gomez, the other defenders have improved under Klopp. They've got a lot more strength and depth than they did last year. Certain players midfield are out, then they've got others to come in. Naby Keita's still got to come good. So much excitement when he arrived and hasn't really reproduced the form that we saw from him in the Bundesliga. But there's obviously huge talent there. Fabinho's started playing well now. And Salah, after that slow start, which is probably a legacy of the Sergio Ramos roughhousing that he got in Kiev, is now starting to score. And that was much more like him, his old self on Saturday. Bournemouth couldn't handle him. Brilliant hat-trick. And I think Klopp said that for the second goal, it was probably a foul. And yet, in that kind of messy way, he kept going. You couldn't knock him off the ball. Mm. The other thing I'd say is that Bournemouth, 2 years ago, that was one of the games where Liverpool were 2-0 up, 3-1 up on two occasions in that game, and they ended up losing to Bournemouth. And you don't really see that happen from them anymore. So they're much harder this season.
Eddie Howe did say, you know, that first goal was offside, and that it could have all been so different. I'm not sure if... I mean, I like Eddie Howe. We all like Eddie Howe, but I think they probably still would have lost, Vishali.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Jacob, you make a really good point. I think there's been so much development under Klopp, particularly from last season, talked about. They've just got a better balance in the team, and they've got more experience now. You know, they obviously just made top four last season, but I think they're running the Champions League to the final. I think it really injected the squad with confidence that, and the fact that they beat City as well last season, and that they can go toe-to-toe with City and really challenge for the title this season. And they're still unbeaten, so we have to take them seriously. They're a point above City, and I think the issue for them, and this is what I was saying throughout their run so far, was that, you know, it's not just about Liverpool's form, it's about City dropping points. To win the title this season, they're going to need City to drop points. City have now dropped points. So if Liverpool can go to the Etihad Stadium on, I think it's 3rd of January, and take points off City, they're going to be in a really good position this season. But I think it's going to be about remaining calm and grinding out the results when they need to, and using the experience from last season to help them this season, because that's what City have over Liverpool. They've got the experience of winning a title.
Obviously, I had that surprise run under Brendan Rodgers in 2014. Nobody saw it coming. And there was, I think it was a much more emotional than they're not. I think as well, it was what it was, that was 25 years since Hillsborough, and when they came into that Manchester City game at home, and it was all this does not slip, and we don't have to go over that. But I think that team didn't have the maturity, and I think this one does. I think they've got a manager who knows what to do if they get in that situation. He's won titles in a tough league before Klopp. I can't see them sort of cracking up like they did 5 years ago.
It was a bad day for Steve Cook. Just one of those days where he just perhaps should have not played football. Just gone shopping or the cinema or something. With two slips and an own goal. We should also credit James Milner, 500 Premier League appearances. Lovely of Mo Salah to give him the Man of the Match award despite his hat-trick. Robbie says, is Tesco finest Roberto Firmino a bigger loss to Liverpool than Tesco value Callum Wilson is to Bournemouth? I'd say no, Barry.
Yeah, Wilson was a huge loss. Him and Lewis Cook were both absent for that game. Interestingly, I think 7 of Bournemouth starting 11 featured in the game, the 4-3 that Jacob was talking about. And if Lewis Cook and Callum Wilson had been fit, it would have been up to 9. And I think that is a bit of a problem for Bournemouth. In a way, it's a testament to the players' trust and faith in their manager and his in theirs, but it does show that they're a bit thin. That's not a very high rate of player turnover in a 2-year period, and I was very disappointed with them on Saturday. The conditions were windy, it didn't help them, but they were the same for Liverpool. But I thought they'd give a much better account of themselves, and I think they've now lost, is it 5 and 6? And that's quite worrying.
A huge game for Liverpool on Tuesday. They host Napoli. Ross says, would a Champions League exit help or hinder their title race? Jacob.
Well, they go into the Europa League for a start.
That's worse,
so
isn't it?
I don't think you want to be in the Europa League. It always affects teams. But Liverpool, the Champions League means as much to them, given their history, even though they haven't won the title since 1990. And yeah, I think it'd be really deflating for them if they go out. It'd be hard for them to recover from that because of what they did last season.
West Ham 3, Crystal Palace 2. Jacob, you were there. Were you excited?
In the second half.
Okay. How was the first?
The first half was bad.
Yeah.
Palace went 1-0 up, and even Hodgson said afterwards that we kind of went 1-0 up, but we didn't really deserve it. And Pellegrini wasn't happy with the way that West Ham played. And obviously without Marko Arnautovic, who's probably going to be out till the start of January, he was starting to think, where's it going to come from for West Ham? Where it came from was Robert Snodgrass, who a year ago was being criticised in an interview with this paper by David Sullivan, the co-owner, saying we shouldn't have signed him. He was a bit unlucky to come in as kind of a replacement, if you'd like, for Dimitri Payet at the same time. And he didn't really do anything. He went on loan to Aston Villa at the start of last season. Bilic didn't like him. But he's come back under Pellegrini, who said lose some weight in the summer. I don't know if you saw Snodgrass's comments last week, where he's saying, well, the problem I had was that I was living in Essex, but going up to Aston Villa every day from home.
Service station
food, and I put on too much weight. Now I've got a 5-mile journey to the training ground, and it's much easier for me.
It's hard to find a salad at Scotch Corner.
Yeah, I don't know what he was eating, but
it's not the idea of a Premier League footballer just filling himself with Burger King. I mean, does this mean he's out of the Snodgrass vortex, Barry?
I think until he goes back into the Snodgrass vortex, he's out of the Snodgrass vortex. But yeah, it seems weird. If you're playing for Aston Villa, why are you living in Essex? It just smacks of a lack of professionalism to me, but, you know.
You've got family and all that. You know, it's not so easy to take everything just wherever you go.
It's the life he has chosen.
That's a bit harsh on Robert, isn't it? Is the London Stadium getting better? I mean, I was just watching West Ham fans being happy when they were winning a game, so maybe I'm being naive to think.
Yeah, when they're playing well, it can be good, and obviously it was an amazing start to the second half because they scored for the second time in 4 or 5 days. They scored 3 goals in about 15 minutes at the start of the second half. So obviously it raises the excitement levels. When it's boring or when they're playing badly, you do find yourself drifting off just because of the distance from the pitch. But there is just, I think there's a shift in mentality as well under Pellegrini, who's changing the way the players approach games now, much more attacking. And Felipe Anderson, another one who stepped up in the absence of Arnautovic and scored his 6th goal of the season. Amazing goal from the edge of the area. And they spent a lot of money on him. And at the start of the season, he was starting to think, you were thinking maybe is he cut out for the Premier League? But he's starting now to really, really show why he was rated so highly. It was a couple of years ago that Manchester United and Pellegrini wanted to bring him to City, but I think he had some injuries at Lazio and fell out of the team last season. But now he's starting to show why. He was 37 million, I think, in the summer.
Vishali, are you worried about Crystal Palace? I mean, I don't know personally if you care, but I mean, are you worried about their position in the Premier League?
I am quite worried, actually. They're losing games, they're conceding just far too many goals, and you look at some of their performances as well, just so much disorganisation in that team. And I do care, because I've got a few friends who are Crystal Palace fans. I've got quite a few friends, actually, are Crystal Palace fans.
I thought you were going to end that sentence going, I've got quite a few friends, actually. nice to be popular.
It is always nice to be popular. So, of course, you know, my friends like Crystal Palace, they want them to stay up. And for me, obviously working at the Evening Stand, it's always good to have another London team to cover, so I'm slightly worried about them. And they've got a tough run of games coming up, so they're gonna have to start picking up points very
Zaha
soon.
Is suspended for Leicester at home on Saturday, 5 bookings,
and with no Zaha, there's no point.
It's sort of worrying times for football in South London, because Millwall are in trouble as well. So you know, if they both got relegated, it would be not great for the locale.
Look, we've already mentioned racism in football. You've had an exclusive about was it a fan representative on the board at West Ham?
The official, the newly formed official supporter board. A guy called Greg Smith, who was on the Democratic Football Lads Alliance March in October, which was where Mark Phillips, the under-18s coach at West Ham, obviously, we had that story in October where he had gone on the march and ended up suspended by West Ham for who were looking into his subsequent social media activity to see whether that had broken any club rules or brought the club into disrepute. And it was found after they'd taken external legal advice, I'm talking very legally here, that he hadn't done so. So back he came, and now they've got this new supporter board. They had a lot of problems in March where they tried to, where there was a coalition of fan groups. There were a lot of fan groups at West Ham.
It's really hard to keep
and
track of
this
it.
Guy, Greg Smith, was part of the Real West Ham Fan Action Group, which then became the Real West Ham Fan Group. And they were accused of orchestrating a campaign against the Independent Supporters Association. Not to suggest that Greg Smith was part of any of that campaign, but the Supporters Association are recognised by the Football Supporters Federation, but West Ham don't seem to want anything to do with them. Their response at the time was a little bit lacking about said alleged abuse, and subsequent, and so that all kind of fell away. They then set up their own official supporters board. It was an enormous process with an independent panel of four, and that has allowed this chap, Greg Smith, to become one of the representatives on the board. Questions about whether West Ham should maybe answer how it was possible for him to get on, given that they would have known who he was for a start, because he was there are minutes that suggest he has been in those meetings back in March, which included Karen Brady, the vice chair. It's all a bit complicated, but it's not great for someone who has marched with the DFLA to be representing fans in that way.
No, certainly doesn't sound it. Anyway, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll begin at the Emirates. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. On the 22nd of January, Barry, what are you doing?
I'm going to Dublin with you.
Great. Who else is coming?
Barney Roney.
Yeah.
And, Lars Sivertsen.
Yeah. And what are we doing there?
Hopefully not spending as long getting home as we did last year.
A live show at Liberty Hall Theatre in Dublin. If you are in or around the Dublin area, please come. Arsenal 1, Huddersfield 0. Arsenal now unbeaten in 21 games in all competitions. They've won 8 points in the final 10 minutes of games in the Premier League this season. Double the next highest team, which is Manchester United. Late, but deserved, Barry, would you say?
I think so. Just looking at my notes of the game here, like, I registered 5 good Arsenal chances. They had a disallowed goal as well, correctly disallowed. But I would commend Huddersfield on an excellent away performance, but they just weren't good enough in the end, and it was a fair result, in my opinion.
I know we've banged on about this forever, but why did... I'm not asking why did Arsene Wenger not buy someone like Torreira, because we've asked that question a million times and no one has the answer to it. But he is so crucial to that side, isn't he, Michelle?
Absolutely. Well, he brought Xhaka in, didn't he? In the same summer that Chelsea bought Kanté. So he did try to shore up that midfield. Unfortunately, Xhaka struggled and does struggle when it comes to defending. But with Torreira in that side, he doesn't have to worry so much about protecting the defence. Torreira is just, what a player he is. Such a little battling kind of performer in the middle of the park for Arsenal. He's definitely got that Uruguayan spirit, hasn't he? And he brings that to Arsenal. He just fights for every ball. He's a very good player. And of course, his goal, overhead kick, it was some goal. So
Alfie says, was Lucas Torreira's goal the greatest tap-in ever? Which is a good question, because it...
No. Traore, the own goal.
Oh, what, the back hit, the double back heel own goal? Fair enough. Eric says, is Torreira inch for inch the best player in the Premier League? Or is that Kante or Aguero? It's got to be Kante.
Yeah, probably. Arsenal are in a bit of trouble now, actually, because they've lost Holding to injury, long-term injuries, probably out for the season. They had 3 players booked for diving in that game, which apparently is unprecedented. I think 2 of them are central defenders who... have now earned themselves suspensions on the totting up procedure. And Lauren Koscielny didn't get a run out. They're expecting him back soon, but they are running out of central defenders.
Hmm. Xhaka, Mustafi and Guendouzi were booked for diving. I thought Mustafi was a little bit unlucky. Guendouzi presumably expecting hair-pulling contact is why he went down. Mustafi and Socrates are both suspended for their next game, and Rob Holding out. So, yeah, no idea who Tony Adams and Steve Bould might be centre-backs next. Did anyone care about the hippie crack story last week that some Arsenal players were... I mean, I'm too old to know what it is. That's not those little canisters that I see on the floor, is it?
If you come to visit me in Brixton someday, and you'd just be ankle deep in them, they're everywhere. But I don't really know much about hippie crack. I believe it's completely harmless and it's not illegal, so it's probably not ideal for athletes to be using it, but it's probably better for them than many other stimulants they could be enjoying.
Hmm. Huddersfield obviously deserved nothing because they unnecessarily wore their away kit when they could have happily gone in Andy Booth blue. So shame on you. Manchester United 4, Fulham 1. Michael says, will winning the Everton Cup be enough to save Mourinho's job? The Everton Cup is a new trophy that we've bought out for whoever finishes 6th or 7th. 6th or 7th?
7th.
7th, yeah. So, you know, they got a good chance of that. Interesting story today about Lukaku saying he was too muscly for Manchester United because he had to be muscly for Belgium in the World Cup. Have you seen this story?
Hmm.
Well, seems strange, doesn't it, that you have a different build for different games?
Yeah, I don't really understand why he felt the need to bulk up so much. And then he said that he was... It held him back in the league because the Premier League, you need to be much lighter, and it must take a lot of time to lose that muscle. I mean that sincerely, because
he could go on the Snodgrass diet.
I don't think he wanted to turn it into fat, Barry. He wanted to lollop about with a little pot belly. Fulham, Vishali, again, not a case of defending badly, but just not defending at all.
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, Ranieri's really got a challenge on his hands there. When I watched them against Chelsea, they looked a bit more improved, but these are still early days for Ranieri, and he's got a lot of work to do, particularly when it comes to his defence, because they're caught out of position so often. And I think there's still remnants of that time under Slavisa Jokanović, the lack of confidence that they had under him, particularly when teams were attacking them. I think there's remnants of that still in this team, and I think Ranieri's going to need a little bit of time. Unfortunately, you don't get that much time in the Premier League. So I think there has been slight improvement despite the scoreline against Manchester United, but he does need time.
B23 says, why is no one at all talking about Rashford's dive and subsequent wrestling that got Anguissa sent off? Surely a masterpiece of shithousery. I mean, I'd suggest there were bigger stories doing the round this weekend, arguably, but look, it was unlucky. And there were rumours at the back end of last week that Maurizio Pochettino was being lined up to replace Jose at the end of the season. George Mendes released a statement to say it's totally untrue. Jose is very happy at the club and the club is very happy with him. He has a long-term contract with Manchester United and is fully committed to the club in building a solid, winning project. Hmm. How do we react to this, Jacob?
Yeah, I believe every word. But the real test will come on Sunday because they're at Liverpool, aren't they? And beating Fulham at home, scoring a lot of goals against Fulham, doesn't mean anything for Manchester United. They should be doing that. They should be doing that every week. And it's just a week before that, they were playing uselessly against Southampton, Young Boys and Palace.
First time they've scored two goals in months and months. Which was very strange as a Manchester United fan.
Burnley put four past Fulham. You know, it's not that hard. Oh. Their defending is comical.
Southampton scored twice.
Manchester United go to Valencia on Wednesday. They can still win the group. They're through already. Leicester 0, Spurs 2. Harry Kane rested for the Barcelona game. Is Heung-min Son the best two-footed player in the Premier League, Vishani?
Ooh,
in the sense that both his feet have the equivalent quality?
Possibly, yeah. Yeah, I'm not actually going to give you an answer on that one.
No, that's okay.
I'm going to suggest De Bruyne.
You say De Bruyne?
Well, do you remember his goal against Chelsea last season?
Yes, it was
his left foot.
Okay. But maybe De Bruyne's right and left are both better than Son's. But Sons are both very good. Anyway, it was a lovely goal from Heung-min Son with his wrong foot.
Yeah, lovely goal. He's I really like him as a player. You know, he doesn't necessarily start all the time for Spurs, but whenever he comes on, he gives his all. And, you know, he's got a good goal rate as well for Spurs. It was a tough game for Spurs because, of course, it was Saturday night. They have to go to the Camp Nou on Tuesday and play against Barcelona. It's a must-win game against Barcelona as well for them to have any hope of progressing into the knockout round. So it was a tough game for them to have to travel away to Leicester. But they got the win, and you know, Pochettino got to rest some of his key players for that trip to Spain as well, like Harry Kane. And we're also starting to see the best of Dele Alli again, which I think is a huge positive for Spurs. He was so dangerous in attack for Spurs on Saturday night, so that's a huge positive for them.
He scored 50 goals. Mm. Dele Alli, and I think people still underrate him. The other thing you mentioned about playing on Saturday night is why BT, who have the Champions League, making Tottenham play on a Saturday night away from home 3 days before they go to Barcelona and they're an English side. And Pochettino was complaining about that. It's just ridiculous that English sides still get no protection from their own league when they go to Europe.
So you're saying it's all Jake Humphrey's fault. But it was ridiculous scheduling.
No one needs it. Well, I understand why. If you're in America, then it's a better time to watch the game.
But you're right,
There could have been another game they put on at that time.
But, you know, once you've had the early kickoff, and then you've had Soccer Saturday or whatever, and you had the late kickoff, you want to watch... I watched Con Air. I had the
and
game
a fine
on,
movie
had,
it
oh,
is
brilliant
too.
Movie. I mean, I had the game on the laptop, but Connor, I mean, that's great entertainment. Weird from Leicester, really. They didn't do much. I'd wrote, Jacob, is Dele Alli underrated? And producer Jonathan said, by who? He won PFA Young Player of the Year 2 years running. He starts for England. You make a good point, but I still tend to agree that people don't.
I think there's
something about.
He blows hot and cold, doesn't he? And I think he's not as consistently good as people expect for a player of his prodigious talent.
Spurs away to Barcelona, as we've said. It all depends really on what team Barca put out. We'll ask Sid that later. Newcastle 1, Wolves 2. Newcastle's seventh defeat in 9 home games. I mean, I felt so bad for Newcastle because they'd held on for so long with 10 men and they looked as good as Wolves when they were down to 10 men as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things where you play 20 minutes with a man down, you're doing well, and then 94th minute a counter-attack comes along and you can see that late goal. And you've got to feel for Rafa Benitez. But, you know, what Kennedy was doing in the build-up to that goal, he completely let Doherty go for that.
Mind you, he must be tired. He came on a minute before.
You've got to be giving more. You really do. I mean, especially when you're a sub fighting for your place in that starting lineup and then you lose the man who ends up scoring the winner. It's not looking good for him. But yeah, I did feel for Newcastle. Of course, they didn't have a penalty as well awarded to them for... Well, I mean, it was an elbow to Ayoze Perez's face. I thought it could have been a penalty, but it wasn't given.
Yeah, Rafa was unhappy with Mike Dean for the sending off as well. Was that a red for you?
I thought it was a red. I can see exactly why he's given it. It was a last man challenge. It was a goal scoring opportunity, I thought. So I wasn't too sort of critical about that decision. I just thought Ayoze Perez could have been awarded a penalty.
Yeah, I think you might have a point. Chris says, is Rafa Benitez trying to fill the blame void left by Mark Hughes by calling for VAR to come in immediately, despite the fact he had no real grievance and no decision would have been overturned? Are you hoping that Rafa takes the Mark Hughes mantle, Barry?
I don't think he will, but you can't introduce VAR at this stage because, you know, halfway through a season, it would be unfair on teams who could, you know, have been hard done by already. So I still can't decide whether or not it should be introduced at all. I was fundamentally against it from the get-go. Then I keep flip-flopping, but I think I should stick with my original gut feeling.
No,
that
it was
VAR
so much,
is a bad thing.
It was so much fun in the World Cup. I just found it really entertaining. That moment where Ronaldo thought he was getting sent off when he left one on someone.
If he had been sent off, then that would have changed my mind completely.
Burnley 1, Brighton 0. The thing I enjoyed about this game was the last 5 minutes where Burnley were just absolutely under the pump and it was cold and wet and just throwing bodies at everything, Burnley, to try and to keep that win. A massively important victory for them, Jacob.
Yeah, well, they've really struggled to replicate last season's high standards when they finished seventh, didn't they? And which is an incredible achievement for Sean Dyche on that budget and with those players. And you thought that once they got over that little period where they had the Europa League games and qualifiers, that it would come back for them. But it just seemed like it's been really hard for them to do that again. I suppose it's a little bit similar to Leicester when the season after they won the league, where you know, relatively you have those highs followed by the problems of trying to keep those levels at the same standards. And for Burnley, they can't really ever afford not to play at 100%. And I'm not suggesting that they haven't been trying under Sean Dyche. It's just probably the mental strain of having to do that again when they didn't really do too much in the summer. It can't be easy, but I don't think that under him that they'll go down, and I think they've probably still got enough to come, especially at home, to get out of it.
A first defeat for Ralph Hasenhüttl. Cardiff 1, Southampton 0, Cardiff's third win in 5 after just 1 in 11. They've got 13 of their 14 points at home this season. An absolutely terrible mistake by Vestergaard, isn't it, Barry? You just think...
Well, you'd forgive anyone an error like that, but Southampton just make them all the time. In nearly every game, there's one horror show moment like that. And the fact that they're incapable of scoring means that those errors are always going to be costly. And, you know, it was, I don't know, it was lapse of concentration or just clumsiness or a mixture of both, but... it's really not what you want to be doing in your first match under a new manager.
Malcolm says, best moustache 11. Where are you putting Callum Patterson? I don't think high.
He reminds me of Paul Rutherford, the dancer from Frankie Goes to Hollywood. One for the dads there. But
he's got an excellent League Two look about him for me. And the fact that he's scoring goals in the Premier League makes me very happy.
And the fact that he's a full back scoring goals.
He's only about 23 as well.
Playing is he?
Yeah.
He's 23?
He's something like 23, 24.
Yes, 24 years old.
Wow,
I had him at 35. I had him, you know, journeyman, sort of Billy Sharp-like. I had him, he's played for everyone. Between, you know, everyone sort of north of Birmingham, I reckon, had had him for a bit. Oh, well, good for him. Everton, Watford tonight.
Why is he playing... as a striker for Cardiff, is it Gary Medine that bad? That
it's Medine, Bobby Reid, and...
Oh, I forgot about him.
Yeah, but no, they haven't really done anything, have they, those strikers? And I think he put him up there in the Championship last season, and it just seemed to work. It shouldn't work, but it does.
It's a bit of a Paul Warhurst about it, isn't it? Do you remember?
Did Warhurst go from back to front? Or
Sheffield
from front
Wednesday,
to back?
He was a central defender, and Sheffield Wednesday played him up front because they... No fit strikers, and he just couldn't stop scoring. John, but he ended up falling between two stools, really, and not being very good at either. But he did
Glenn Hoddle played Dion Dublin at centre back a couple of times, didn't he? And then in 98, they were like, oh, he should go to the World Cup because he can do that job as well.
Chris Sutton did it as well.
Yeah, he did.
But Patterson's been playing up front for Scotland as well, I think. He's an international forward.
I'll be brutally honest. I just thought he was a centre forward. He never crossed my radar as a
He's a right
defender.
Back by trade.
Producer Jonathan says, John Charles. Did John Charles do that too? He could do everything, though, I imagine, John Charles.
Rude Hullett. He's the new Hullett.
He's the next Rude Hullett. Everton Watford tonight. Alan says, if you were Mrs. Big Sam, where would you be focusing your efforts on finding short-term rental homes?
Oh, that's a good question. Mm. I would be concerned that Roy Hodgson may lose his job, but I don't think Big Sam would get the gig in the event of Roy getting his P45.
So. Yes, but they could go back to wherever they were the last time he was there. He was there, wasn't he?
He was there, yeah.
And been everywhere.
Didn't he leave because he was retiring for about 2 seconds?
Possibly.
And then came back to Everton. He's got Casa del St. James's, hasn't he?
Although I've asked him about this. It's not called that. Okay. Sadly, it's very upsetting. And he apparently didn't buy it with the payoff he got from Newcastle.
Yeah, well, if Rafa leaves, then...
That's a good point.
You know, I think he'd be welcomed back with open arms, wouldn't he?
Well, certainly. Unless West Ham slide, yeah. He could pop back there.
Yep.
In the Football League, in the Championship, fun game at Carrow Road saw Norwich beat Bolton 3-2. Timu Pukki with a last-minute winner after Bolton had come back from 2-0 down. Norwich atop, a point ahead of Leeds. Kemar Roofe getting both goals in a 2-1 win over QPR. Sheffield United a third, Derby fourth. after winning at Wigan. West Brom are fifth. They drew 2-2 with Aston Villa. Villa should have scored about 100 goals in this game before Jade Rodriguez bundled one in with his hand. And after the ball had gone in, he spent quite a long time with his just head in the turf, hoping that no one had noticed that it had gone in off his hand. He's obviously not got a poker face. He just stayed down there and then got up and celebrated. In League One, Portsmouth are 6 points clear at the top after a 2-0 win over Southend. Luton up to second, leapfrogging Sunderland, whose game was abandoned in the 75th minute, which seems very late to abandon a game, doesn't it, because of a waterlogged pitch. It was 1-1. Accrington's equaliser was scored by on-loan Bolton striker Connor Hall. It would have been his first league goal, but obviously it's been chalked off. So pray for Connor. It was a great goal-mouth scramble as well.
Sunderland fans at that game, as an homage to the forthcoming Netflix documentary, which I'm looking forward to watching all 8 episodes after this podcast is recorded, were singing Sunderland Till I Dry.
Very good.
At Accrington.
League 2 wins for the top three, MK Dons, Lincoln and Colchester. Colchester beat bottom side Macclesfield in Sol Campbell's first league game in charge. Cambridge United robbed again. This time 1-0 at Tranmere. Oh, God. Managerless and one place above the relegation zone. Dave says, was there any bigger upset than Chesterfield 2, Salford 0 in the National League this weekend? 20 league games without a win for Chesterfield versus 20 league games without a defeat for Salford. So well done, Chesterfield. In the FA Cup, all the kickoff times have been announced for the FA Cup third round. 32 games. How many do you think are going to kick off at 3 p.m. on Saturday?
I have no idea.
For Charlie?
No idea.
Jacob?
3.
It's 10.
Oh.
That's 22 games have been moved for either domestic or international broadcasters. Does that mean it's the end of football? Is that a terrible thing? Or is that, that, I don't think the ship has sailed, right?
I don't think it is the end of football, but yeah, FA Cup third round day, what used to be one of my favourite days of the football calendar, and it isn't anymore, and it hasn't been for some time. You don't get many shocks. Premier League sides don't field full strength teams, and I think the stable or the horse in that one bolted a long time ago.
I don't mind a Friday night game. Germany Bundesliga complaining about Monday night football. I would happily lose that in a heartbeat. I don't know. Premier League,
like tonight.
Yeah,
okay. I agree with Barry though. It's lost its luster a little bit.
The magic of the cup.
The 3 o'clock games and. Even the championship sides, it's not that big for them as well, I think, anymore. But the promotion to the Premier League is where it's at for them, isn't it? And
that's true.
Would you want a cup run necessarily?
Oh, they are great, though. When it's your team, it's great.
Yeah, but the thing is, how far are you actually realistically going to go?
Oh, for like
the top six are so strong anyway. The last 3 or 4 years, the semi-finals have just been the top six.
Mm. But, I mean, for lower league, it's about making money, right? It's about...
Well, do you remember Chesterfield's famous cup run when they got to the semi-final and were robbed against Middlesbrough, should have got to the final? That was terrific. Like, that was just really exciting. Everyone got behind them. But even if a team managed that now, they're not going to be beating sides who are particularly taking the competition seriously. So it's still good for them. For neutral observers, it's
Last season, obviously, they beat Manchester City after the Fabian Delph red card, but quarterfinals was as far as they went. And then after that, Premier League sides and Chelsea, Spurs, United in the last four.
And
Southampton. Southampton, who lost, and then you get your big sides in the final.
Yeah. Fitbar, Barry, order has been restored.
Yeah, Celtic demolished Kilmarnock 5-1 to knock them off the top spot and go top of the league. Kilmarnock are down to third now because Rangers got a point which elevated them to second, but it wasn't a very good point because it was earned on the back of a 1-1 draw against Dundee, who were bottom of the table and played 70 minutes with 10 men. Kenny Miller, who is aged 75, a former Rangers player, he ran them ragged. And Steven Gerrard, for the second time, I think, in a week, absolutely ripped his players a new one publicly after the game. Said they're undisciplined, said they won't follow his instructions, they won't stick to his game plan. And he looks like a man who's really reaching the end of his tether. And elsewhere, Hearts beat Motherwell to go fourth. In a game that was overshadowed by racial abuse of Motherwell's substitute Christian Mbulu. Two men out of a gang of about 20 who were recorded in the terraces have been arrested and banned indefinitely by Hearts as well. And the Motherwell boss, Stephen Robertson, said the act was an absolute disgrace. I've just seen the video of it. I thought this was 2018, but that was the dark ages and dinosaur stuff. For a player to have that, to take that kind of stuff is disgusting. So Mbulu was warming up as a sub and he just got subjected to this horrific abuse. And it's a bit worrying for Hearts because, you know, we've seen recently that footage of or their fans doing a sort of a tribute or an homage to Tommy Robinson, and it's worrying.
This is from Rob. Says it wasn't just Manchester City who lost their unbeaten record this week. The new Manchester United women's team went down 3-1 at Durham in their first ever defeat. Good news for women's football in the North East after the region was overlooked by the FA for those Euro 2021 venues. And we should also say congratulations to Atlanta United, who won their first ever MLS Cup. They beat Liam Ridgewell's Portland Timbers. We don't have time to go into it in detail today, but we will discuss it a little bit further on Thursday. And that'll do for part two. Part three begins with Sid Lowe out in Spain. Welcome to part three, the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain. Say hello to Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you doing?
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, excellent. Thanks. You were at the Bernabeu for the Copa Libertadores final, River 3, Boca 1 after extra time. How was it?
Well, it's been curious watching the whole thing unfold, not just the game, but the whole build-up to it. It's completely dominated Spanish football this weekend as well. So it's kind of dominated the media, it's dominated the conversation, it's been a huge focus here. And a kind of a sense, I think, of people wanting to experience this game, and this game being sort of different from the way that European football is, that touch, if you like, of I don't know if you call it authenticity, slightly wildness, a little bit untamed. And yet, of course, it was never quite going to be like that because relatively few people came from Argentina, although it was in the high thousands. A lot of tourists there, a lot of Argentinians from around Europe, a lot of football fans who were curious. It was never going to be quite the same. So it wasn't the, if you like, the kind of the huge explosion or the huge expression of what this rivalry is, but it was, in terms of atmosphere, very noisy, very loud, like a really, really good Champions League night at the Bernabeu. And perhaps on one level, at least from that point of view, it might even have been slightly bigger than a Superclásico would normally be, because of course it had fans from both sets of teams. What was wild and what really was kind of like, if you like, the embodiment of it was the game itself, and certainly the last 25 minutes, well, 15, 25 minutes or so, were absolutely incredible.
And did River deserve it?
They certainly did. Once Quintero came on, I think the second half, they dominated the ball. They had much more of it. They created a reasonable number of chances. I mean, I need to see a replay. Still haven't, but it seems to me that they had a reasonably good penalty shout turned down as well. The goals, all four goals actually, were really brilliant. But it was a game that was largely pretty dirty, largely quite edgy, but kind of for the rawness of it in the last 15-20 minutes was brilliant. And you know, you've got that moment where River scored the goal, and as I think they probably did just about deserve it, the 2-1 up, but in the very last minute Boca hit the post. At that point the goalkeeper's playing up front, but it's not just at that point, he didn't play up front for the last minute, he played up front for about the last 8 or 9 minutes. It was really quite something. I mean, genuinely, he was ahead of other of his teammates. You know, he would have a defender behind him and he's further up the pitch, he's up in the penalty area, you know, they hit the post in the very last minute. And then when they get caught, and this is the image that really sticks with me of the end of the game, is when they get caught for the third goal. Obviously this is pretty much the last second of the game, the goalkeeper's up, and suddenly River break away, and of course you've got a man running through the middle of the pitch, no one in front of him, running to the goal, and at that point his teammates are so sure that he's going to score, they don't run in a straight line with him. They start running all over the place. So you have this kind of thing where it's almost like a Catherine wheel and the sparks are going off in all directions. So he's running in a straight line to the goal, but his teammates, some are running over to the bench, some are running to each other. It's just kind of really embodied, if you like, the kind of chaos of the last 15, 20 minutes, which were really, really pretty good fun. Until then, truth be told, the quality wasn't always great, although, as I said, the quality in all four goals is really quite something.
Do you reckon Leo Messi was reacting to being fifth in the Ballon d'Or at the weekend?
Yeah, I mean, this is I'm writing about this now and trying to kind of get my head around this, because of course I like everyone in the media in a way, and I'm guilty of this. I'm guilty of this sort of sense that because Messi is so relentlessly brilliant, because he is good almost every week, because he's so far ahead of everyone else in terms of the kind of the regularity with which he produces performances that are extraordinary, we kind of get a bit blasé about it. And he, up to a point, he, I think, becomes a victim of his own standards. And so I think what happens is that it takes a really special performance for us to talk about him. And this weekend was, even by his standards, it was extraordinary against Espanyol. He scores two brilliant free kicks, first time he's ever scored two in a game. So there he is, finally doing something that he hadn't done before, you know, finally exceeding his own expectations. But it's not just that, it's the assist, it's the five chances that he makes, it's the running, it's the passing, it's everything. But I think there's another element, and I think the element is bound up in your question. It's not just that he played brilliantly, it's also the timing of it. Now, the timing of it may well be that partly encourages him to produce an even better performance than even he normally does. But I also think what it does in a way is perhaps it makes the excuse for the rest of us to write about it. And as I say, I'm guilty of this too, because I'm now writing about this. Whereas if it wasn't in the context of the Ballon d'Or, if it wasn't in the context of Pelé saying that he's not very good in the air, he's only got one trick, he's only got one leg. I mean, we know that, and I think I once said on a podcast that Pelé doesn't know shit, which of course is a slightly unfair thing to say. but there is an element of Pelé saying stupid things. A great player, but maybe not always saying the most sensible things. And so you do wonder if Messi might have been a bit hyper-motivated by that. And there's a moment when he dashes back and wins the ball back. And it's almost stupid, isn't it, that a player this good, we all get excited when he runs back and wins a tackle. I mean, that shouldn't be the defining moment. But that did sort of feel like it kind of embodied, if you like, yeah, that kind of that extra little touch of desire this weekend to try and make a point. And inevitably, everybody, and again, you know, I'm partly to blame for this as well, on Saturday night, you could not move for tweets of people saying, fifth in the world, and this is the fifth best player in the world, which of course misses the point a bit, because it's a Player of the Year award. It's not necessarily an award for who is the best. It's an award for who has had the best year. But yeah, I all of that kind of comes together to create this perfect storm. And then the other thing, I suppose, to underline how we get too used to how good Messi is that Messi scores two free kicks, two brilliant free kicks. The second of them is in the 65th minute. He has 25 minutes to score a third, to get a hat-trick of free kicks. And at the end, you actually feel disappointed that he hasn't done it.
Will Barca rest all their players against Spurs?
I don't think they'll rest all of them, but I think they'll rest a lot of them. Valverde was asked about this, and he said, look, we will respect the competition, which, of course, he has to say. But he also said, we owe our loyalty to ourselves, not to Inter Milan. I think the fact that Barcelona have had three or four reasonably important injuries, particularly at the back, more than anywhere else. I mean, Samuel Umtiti has missed most of the season and may well miss most of what's left. Given that they overplay both Alba and Busquets, even to a point, you could say they probably overplay Messi. I think there will be changes. I don't think it will be the entire team, but I would expect of a normal Barcelona starting 11, I wouldn't be at all surprised if half of them are missing, if four, five, maybe six of them are missing.
Real Madrid, Atletico, they both won. No win in three for Alaves, two draws in a row for Sevilla. Will either of those two be able to keep up with the three, or is that them starting to slip?
No, I don't think Alaves will, but I don't think anyone ever thought Alaves would. I mean, they were massively overachieving, and what they've done is pretty extraordinary. And actually, it's a year's worth of games now where they're the fourth best team in La Liga. But I think it will drift slightly. But you know, they may well compete for the final European place. I think Sevilla will compete for a Champions League place, but possibly not the league title. Although they will be taken seriously in the meantime. I think it almost certainly will be Barcelona, Atletico, and if Madrid improve, Madrid. But I mean, for example, this weekend, Madrid won and they kept a clean sheet away from home, which is the first time in God knows how long. But the truth be told, they were awful. And there's a lovely line from Courtois, which basically sums it up. He says, we did practically nothing in the second half. The only person who did anything was him, who saved Real Madrid a couple of times. And it's a dreadful miss as well from Melero. And you know, this is away at a team that's bottom of the table.
And a 4-4 at Eibar this week.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm going to try and see if I can get the order right. 1-0, 1-1, 2-1. So 2-1 for the team that was 1-0. I think it's three comebacks. Anyway, it finishes 4-4. And I love the way that Mendilibar said about this. He said, you know, we could basically go back and cover our asses, but that's just not the way we play. That's not the way I am. And unfortunately, sometimes players take on the manager's personalities.
That's it. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Cheers. Cheers.
From Sid Lowe, we'll go to Germany. And here is a WhatsApp report from Lukas Podolski's kebab shop. Your reporter is Archie Rintut.
So, this weekend, it was the biggest derby that the Bundesliga has to offer right now, the Revier Derby, as Schalke hosted Borussia Dortmund. The match winner was the teenager who's having such a great season for Dortmund, England's very own Jadon Sancho. A fifth goal to go with his 8 assists, but this the most significant goal and moment of his time in Germany so far. After Thomas Delaney nodded Dortmund in front in the first half and a Daniel Caligiuri penalty pegged them back after half-time, Sancho played a 1-2, dribbled past another and curled at home to make it 2-1 with just over 15 minutes to go. A very good goal indeed. At which point, he celebrated by raising both arms to the sky. I spoke to him after the game and Sancho told me that this was for his grandmother who passed away during the week. For him to play as well as he did, given that happening, makes his performance only more impressive. What about his performances on the whole? Well, on the one hand, there have been some games this season where Sancho has had trouble making an impression. The first half against Bayern springs to mind, a game away at Mainz too. But as the second half in that Bayern game, for example, proved, he is a quick learner. And it's to Borussia Dortmund's advantage. Now, 22 points clear of arch-rival Schalke, who finished above them last season, remember, but in 13th now. Dortmund on top of the Bundesliga, of course. Still 7 clear of nearest challengers, Borussia Mönchengladbach. They kept up their 100% home record in the league this season by seeing off Stuttgart 3-0 on Sunday. That was the same scoreline that third place Bayern won by on Saturday at home against Nuremberg. Robert Lewandowski scoring twice, though, whisper it quietly, I don't think he's played all that well since that Champions League semi-final last season against Real Madrid. Still, 9 Bundesliga goals for the season for him, 1 goal off top spot. 2 other things to mention. One, that fourth place Leipzig were beaten 3-0 at Freiburg, not a result that many would have expected. And a word for Augsburg goalkeeper Andreas Luther. Lost 1-0 at Leverkusen on Saturday, but during the course of that, in a challenge with opponent Kevin Folland, he bit part of his own tongue off. Certainly the most unorthodox injury of the Bundesliga season so far, and definitely one of the most painful.
Thank you, Archie. In France, only 4 games in Ligue 1 this weekend at the request of regional police forces. That's because of the Gilets Jaunes protests taking up a lot of their time and resources. No PSG this weekend, no Monaco versus Nice, meaning we'll have to wait to see Thierry Henry and Patrick Vieira face off against each other as managers. Of the games that went ahead, the most significant saw second place Lille draw with Reims to cut the gap at the top to a mere 13 points. And Amiens climbed out of the relegation zone with a 2-1 win at bottom side Guingamp.
PSG have drawn their past 2 league games, so they could be argued they are in crisis.
They're starting to crack. To Italy now, and here is Paolo Bandini.
Well, this was not a good weekend in Italy for football fans who leave games early to beat the traffic. But it was a tremendous weekend for people like me who like to moan about people who leave early to beat the traffic. We got a 95th minute equaliser in Sardinia as Cagliari came from 2 goals down to draw with Roma despite being down to 9 men. We got a 96th minute equaliser, Fiorentina away to Sassuolo. Fiorentina actually been down 3-1 in the 89th minute of that game and had a player sent off between their last 2 goals. And we then got a 99th minute equaliser, Sampdoria away to Lazio, who had only gone ahead themselves courtesy of a VAR awarded penalty in the 95th minute. Oh, and to complete the set, Bartosz Berezinski also sent off for Samp as well. So all of those teams that made the late comeback, all at least one player sent off. So basically it was a brilliant weekend when lots happened, but also kind of nothing happened, since all of these draws meant that the table mostly wound up looking exactly the same. The one big winner from the weekend, predictably enough, was Juventus, who beat Inter 1-0 thanks to a goal from Mario Mandzukic. Though only after a first half, I should say, in which the Nerazzurri did hit the post, generally played them very well. And Napoli also warmed up for their Champions League decider with Liverpool by emulating the Reds' own 4-0 win from earlier on Saturday afternoon. The opposition admittedly was only Loli Frosinone, but Napoli will be encouraged by a brace for Arkadiusz Milik, who now has the best goals to minutes ratio in all of Serie A, and perhaps even more importantly, a full 90 minutes for Fawzi Ghoulam, the really very brilliant left-back who has missed the last 13 months for Napoli after tearing knee ligaments in last season's Champions League group stage against Manchester City. He might not start against Liverpool. I'd say it's more likely that Mario Rui will come in for this one, having had the rest of the weekend, but in any case, definitely big news for Napoli going forward this season.
Thank you, Paolo, with that report. Any other business? Brendan says, after beating Kilmacud croaks?
Kilmacud.
How do you think Malinalagata St. Columbus will...
Let me see that.
...will do in the All-Ireland Football Club Championship? Hashtag Ask Barry.
I couldn't care less. I've never heard of that team, weirdly, and I hate Gaelic football, so...
All right. Well, I'm sure Brendan's glad he asked.
Sorry, Brendan.
Mark says, should Yorkshire puddings be served with Christmas dinner? No.
I don't like Yorkshire puddings.
Vishali?
Probably not.
Jacob?
You're asking the wrong ethnicity.
Why?
Jewish? I have no idea.
Do you do no Christmas? Oh, so I'm half Jewish, but, you know, Auntie Gay will have a pigs in blanket. So maybe, you know, we've sort of given that up.
Okay.
In a hypothetical world,
I don't know what's on the proper table.
Turkey, ham, spuds, vegetables.
So no Yorkshire puddings.
Well, generally, you've got your stuffing, your bread sauce.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you've got sausage, bacon wrapped around a sausage, which I presume not. You know that wouldn't.
No. If you did that, that would be too much.
It's not kosher. Yeah. I'm with you. My great uncle Louis wouldn't have liked that.
No.
If you've got turkey or ham, I wouldn't have both necessarily. Then a Yorkshire pudding goes with beef, doesn't it?
I'm not that fond of Christmas dinner, to be honest. I'm not a fan of turkey, and I hate Brussels sprouts. I can't be in the room with a Brussels sprout.
Brussels sprouts probably what Vishali has for breakfast, isn't it?
I don't, actually. I don't. I'm not a fan of Brussels sprouts either.
It's okay, Barry, because Yotam Ottolenghi did 20 alternative Christmas recipes in the Saturday Guardian. So there you go.
Yeah, well, Mark Glendening only knows one, I think.
Producer Jonathan writes, end this now. This is enough nonsense. Jacob, thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Vishali, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me on.
Barry, thanks.
You're welcome.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.